Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 208 of CJ Evolution. Patrick here. I'm the host and creator of this great show we call CJ Evolution. This is a podcast for the criminal justice professional out there like you, hosted by me, another CJ professional. But if you're a first-time listener, if you're not in the criminal justice field, we welcome you. We want you to be here. We want you to listen to the show. We hope you're enjoying the shows, and you're always welcome back. If you're a long-time listener, welcome back again. We hope you're enjoying the shows and the guests. If you head over to cjevolution.com, you rate and review my podcast on iTunes, I sure would appreciate it. Special thanks to all those first responders out there, brave men and women who work in the criminal justice field, whatever you're doing in this field, thank you for what you're doing. You're all heroes in my book. Many, many, many more people out there think the same. I'm so excited to have our next guest on the show. We talk so much about leadership and how to become better law enforcement professionals and better people in general. My next guest served honorably for 27 years in some of the highest levels in the federal government law enforcement arena. I hope you love this next guest. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have Andrew Bringle on the show. If you don't know who Andrew is, he's considered a subject matter expert, SME, regarding criminal profiling, combating violent extremism, relational policing processing, crisis negotiations, and a myriad of other expertise. Andrew, are you there, sir?
I am here. Thank you very much, Pat, for having me here tonight.
Well, thank you so much. I know you're very busy, sir. You're a very busy man. I gave a little bit of a bio there. Can you fill in the gaps?
Well, I spent 27 years in the FBI, 10 years early on in the field before I went into management. I worked a lot of different cases, but if I'm known for anything, it was finding nails. They were 18 finishing nails galvanized with an off-centered punch. They were used in an IED in 1989 to kill the federal judge, a guy named William Vance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the guy that built the bomb and killed him was a guy named Walter Leroy Moody. He was in Georgia. Vance was in Alabama. It was my first field office. And as a new agent, they don't give you a lot of responsibility. So that my whole job for the first several months of my career was to look for these very unique finishing nails that were used as shrapnel in the improvised explosive device. Mm-hmm. I was lucky more than skilled when I was at a Kroger grocery store over the 4th of July weekend, 1990. And I was there principally to buy groceries, of course, and some wood glue for a piece of furniture that had been broken, when I spotted these nails on the shelf that looked exactly like the photographs of the evidence that I'd been looking
for. And you were like, aha.
I had the big aha moment, exactly. I bought the nails out of my own pocket, $2.42, not that I, you know, forget things like that. The Bureau never reimbursed me. I took the nails back to the field office, gave them to the agent that was in charge of collecting all the evidence, and immediately when he compared them, using comparative analysis with the photographs, said, those look like the nails. We need to send them to the lab. And you know you can date nails.
Wow.
Yeah, so metallurgists, the people who study metals, mm-hmm. and you know the different serrations in ballistics, they can actually take a piece of wire, nails, or actually from a wiring company, and if they can find the machine that manufactured the nail, they can actually date the nail in a batch or a lot. And that's what they did. The metallurgist and the case agent flew to Taiwan. They identified the manufacturing plant. They looked at the nails that were used in the IED that killed the federal judge and injured his wife, and also killed an NAACP lawyer mm-hmm. to hide the first crime. And the forensic science was such back in 1990 that they could measure the time frame of the nails, and they dated them an hour before or an hour after the nails that were used in the bomb that killed the judge.
God, that's amazing.
Yeah, what's really amazing is that's all great science in investigation and analysis, but you know, police work is a lot about developing relationships. In fact, as a lecturer on human behavior, I would tell the audience that police do two things. We develop relationships and we disrupt relationships.
Mm-hmm. That's a good
point.
And
if I were lecturing to a group of criminals, say Al-Qaeda operatives, I would tell them that they only do two things. They develop relationships and they disrupt relationships. So in this case, the agent, her name was Tracy North. She became a high-level FBI employee. She ended up befriending the wife of Walter Leroy Moody. Mm-hmm. And Susan McBride, Moody's wife, told the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. She said that in November 1989, they went to the Kroger grocery store, wherein Walter Leroy Moody instructed his wife to steal these 8D finishing nails. She refused to do so. When they got back out to the car, he reached into his pocket and he showed her the nails that he had shoplifted. And he used those nails later to build the bomb that killed the federal judge and an NAACP lawyer.
Oh, Jesus. Wow.
That was critical testimony at the federal state trial. Walter Leroy Moody was found guilty in both cases. The state of Alabama put him on death row. He was there for 28 years. He was executed about 3 weeks ago.
It's amazing.
Yeah, that was my first case in the FBI. First case in 27 years. It kind of, you know, sort of launched me, if you will, in terms of the passion of understanding human behavior. I worked a five-year case against the Genovese as the case agent in a RICO investigation. I worked a number of public corruption investigations. I worked the Eric Robert Rudolph abortion clinic bombing that occurred in Birmingham, Alabama. And then I went to headquarters and the counterterrorism division. Eventually, I ended up at the behavioral science unit. And I spent a bulk of my career studying human behavior and relationships and how policing influences those relationships. Mm-hmm. What we call relational policing.
Now, what drove you to the career that you or the life that you chose, Andrew? What was the catalyst? Because you're very accomplished, very experienced. Did you always know what you wanted to do at a very young age, or what was the catalyst, if there was?
Really, I think, you know, life presents us with opportunities, Pat, and my father was still is a major influence in my life. I always looked up to my father, like a number of us do. My father was a career Army officer, and he gave me some good advice early in my life, because I was with a company called Eastern Airlines. I was a station manager with Eastern, the Wings of Man. And I was laying off about 57 employees and closing down the station in Milwaukee, Wisconsin during a bankruptcy. At 29 years old, I really had no clue where I was going to go from there. Mm-hmm. My father said, and I asked him, I said, you know, Dad, you had a career in the Army. You never had to worry about being laid off. You know, you were very accomplished. And how did you decide to do that? And he said, I didn't. He said, I looked at every opportunity as an opportunity to do my best. I always wanted to do my best in whatever job I had. And the better I did at that job, the more opportunities presented themselves. Mm-hmm. So with that, my father introduced me to an FBI agent. I had a background in criminology. My bachelor's degree was in criminology. And I honestly, Pat, I only took that courses in criminology to follow my sister. I followed her to the same college. And then I got a degree in education, a master's degree at the University of Virginia. And that really, I think, set me on the course of researching and studying and developing tools to improve an investigator's heuristics, their cognitive process as they go through the investigations that they're involved in.
Yeah. And I know you mentioned, and thank you for your father's service to the military. And I know you have a long working history with the military participating in a variety of exercise, red cell exercises, some writing, training military personnel from the Pentagon to Fort Bragg, Quantico, Camp Lejeune, Camp Pendleton. Can you talk a little bit about those experiences?
I can. I will preface it by saying that I had the great honor of spending a bulk of my career instructing police executives and rank and file officers, as well as warfighters around the country. I was in the behavioral science unit, and so a lot of the mystique from that unit came from movies and TV shows. And I received a phone call from a captain at Fort Bragg who asked me if I had any curriculum, soft skills, on that would help them in village stability operation work. So I had already studied Petraeus's COIN manual. Mm-hmm. And it reads, you're a police officer, Pat, so it reads like a police manual in terms of how you would use community-oriented policing to identify risk in a community that you could then define as an intelligence requirement, and how the intelligence analyst can then vet and measure that risk threat so that they have a measurable threat that you can apply intelligence-led policing practices against, so you can infiltrate the criminal group and then neutralize them before they have a chance to act. Mm-hmm. So I met with the captain, and we talked and discussed what they were looking for. And village stability operations requires security, then governance, and then development. And I said, well, that's similar to the way police look at problem-oriented policing and how they approach it in terms of broken window theory with security, saturate the bad area in town with police officers, and then go in and build community relations, and then maybe a basketball court or a civic center, and then hope when they pull those officers out that the bad guys don't creep back in. Mm-hmm. And so we had this long discussion, and I said, you know, there's some fallacies with that model, and some of the research we had done at the Behavioral Science Unit helps in that governance piece. So he asked me to teach, and I did, and word of mouth spread. So I ended up teaching at Quantico. Ended up teaching at the Combat Hunter School in Camp Lejeune. And then I was invited to teach police officers in Pendleton. So it really kind of opened a whole new area for me of instruction. Yeah. I was focused on policing, and then all of a sudden now I'm talking to warfighters.
Yeah. That's such cool stuff. I was down at Bragg. I was in the 82nd.
Thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you. But it is amazing stuff. I mean, to work with the military and talk and do what you're doing and talk about what you're doing. Kind of shifting gears back to the BSU, you talked about the mystique behind the behavioral sciences unit. And because, you know, maybe I shouldn't say most, but some people know, they associate that obviously with the profilers, and they think, can you tell us some of you hit it, some of the mystique behind the BSU, because I think some people think, well, there's a profiler's assigned to the case, everything's going to be solved.
Right.
Yes. And that's just another piece of the puzzle, which I don't think people realize.
I'll tell you, Pat, if I sat down with you for 20, 30 minutes, and this is true with most police officers I've met, and we discussed some of the soft skills that you already know and apply, some of the levels of emotional intelligence among rank-and-file police officers surpasses my abilities in quote-unquote profiling human behavior. Mm-hmm. There is evidence-based approaches. There are some scientific studies and some techniques that can be used to look at behaviors, particularly deception and other factors in terms of behavior and threat. But most police officers who've done the job for some time have at least some level in terms of skills and intuition in that area. So what the Behavioral Science Unit does well, or did, now it's called the Behavioral Analysis Unit 5, is research these techniques and then teaches them to police officers in terms that they may use but weren't familiar with. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you an example, because I did a lot of work in terms of influence and sway. So there's three processes that a police officer uses if they're looking to develop a confidential human source. The first one is elicitation. So the natural introduction process of two people first meeting and discussing their backgrounds is to look for common ground. That commonality represents the birds of a feather who flock together. Mm-hmm. So the more you can identify in terms of commonality, the more you can establish a baseline of expected norms of behavior. And everything is held against that baseline in terms of trust or rapport building versus control, which requires like coercion in order to seek that stability and balance and predictability of behavior against that baseline. Mm-hmm. So it all sounds very complicated, but in fact, when we teach it, we teach three steps. The elicitation process, which is active listening, right? God gave you two ears and one mouth, so listen twice as much as you speak.
Yep.
And as you listen to and elicit from the target, what you're going to hear are his motives or her motives. And they're going to be either expressive or feeling. I call it the James T. Kirk motive. Or they're going to be instrumental, more Mr. Spock. So if you ask three separate questions, very easy. How do you feel, fill in the blank, about whatever topic? What do you want? And how do you plan on getting it? That tells you everything you need to know about the orientation of your target, whether they're more expressive, more James T. Kirk, more goal and logic-based, like Mr. Spock, and whether or not they've actually thought through a plan to accomplish the outcomes and the outputs they're looking for. So the elicitation process gives us what we need through either personal, economic, political, or social motives to construct a solicitation, a way that I can help the informant help himself. Now, it might be, hey, listen, buddy, you're going to jail for a long time unless you cooperate. Mm-hmm. And that's the classic approach that police officers and FBI agents use. But in more cases, particularly in cases where you don't have a hammer against that subject, you're going to have to look at his personal motive, economic motive.
Exactly.
His political motive or his social motive. Sometimes, and I was very successful pitching people for God and country. Do the right thing. Mm-hmm. So the point is that when you get the solicitation package, which is the message, and you give it in a way that the person it resonates with your target, now you're close to the consummation. So it's solicitation, and consummation.
Interesting.
Now, here's the interesting thing, Pat. Mm-hmm. If I were teaching a group of men how to find the love of their life, how to go to a bar and pick up women, guess what model I would teach them? Elicitation, mm-hmm. solicitation, and consummation.
Hmm. Interesting. And that goes in with the relational policing processes that you're talking about, or that you're an expert in.
Yeah, so here's the thing about relational policing. Relational policing encompasses all three functions of policing. So mm-hmm. when I teach police officers, the first question I ask for a show of hands. So I'll say to the room of officers, I'll say, raise your hand if you identify as a law enforcement officer. How many hands do you think go up? All the hands,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Everybody's a law enforcement officer.
Yeah.
And I say, keep your hands raised or raise your hand if you're an intelligence officer. And the hands will start dropping. Mm-hmm. And then I say, well, raise your hand or keep your hands raised if you're a peace officer. And even fewer hands are held up. Mm-hmm. And then I say, let me postulate this. Those are three functions of policing. Peace officer, intelligence officer, law enforcement officer. Those are three functions of policing. You should identify as a police officer. Mm-hmm. The others are functions of policing. If you identify as a function, law enforcement, which is should only be used as a last resort, don't be surprised when your community sees you as an enforcer of the law and not a keeper of the peace. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about community-oriented policing, we talk about a philosophy of engaging our community and having them cooperate. National Night Out is a form of community-oriented policing. And the Behavioral Science Unit looked at it differently. The unique way we looked at it was community-oriented policing, which includes four different steps, is about identifying risk in the community. So if I see new graffiti in my community, that's a disruptor. Mm-hmm. And we know that disruptors lead to conflict, and conflict that's not resolved leads to crisis. So if we don't know what this graffiti means, that becomes an intelligence requirement. What is it I don't know that I need to know about this graffiti? Mm-hmm. So the bridge between community-oriented policing and intelligence-led policing is identifying the risk and then measuring the threat. And you measure that threat by identifying that intelligence requirement and defining it. So mm-hmm. what is it I don't know that I need to know about that graffiti allows me then to use the tradecraft of intelligence-led policing to covertly identify whether we have a new click of MS-13 in my community. Mm-hmm. Because if we did, that's a disruptor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So then we can, as a police officer or department, we can decide whether or not we want to use covert means like an undercover, or we want to use overhears, or if we simply want to introduce someone in that community that can redirect the behavior, ecologically change the environment so that instead of going to commit crimes, we can identify the offender, provide a handler, provide them with the message, the messenger, and the methods to redirect the behavior to a law-abiding manner. Mm-hmm. If not, we reserve, as the last resort, the enforcement piece. We neutralize the criminal before they have a chance to sell drugs, prostitution or mm-hmm. human trafficking or murder or worse. Mm-hmm. Not much worse than murder, though.
Yeah. What do you
think? That's the process.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, that's the process of relational policing.
What do you think, Andrew? What do you think some of the challenges, and we probably hit on a couple of them, but what do you think some of the other challenges for law enforcement are today? You've been in law enforcement many years.
Yeah.
What do you think some of the big challenges? I mean, maybe part of it is, improving community policing, or what else do you think are some of the big challenges out there for law enforcement? And that could be the federal level like you were on, or state or local, everything.
I think there's several challenges for police going into the 21st century. The first, and not to be minimized, is the emergence of new technologies that affect the job of police officers. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we see today are cameras, body cameras. In fact, just recently, there's been two cases of false allegations, of racism and sexual misconduct.
I saw that on the news, and it was exonerated the officers based on the body cam footage.
Based on body cameras. Now, right. I know a lot of police officers that are against body cameras. I know FBI agents are totally against
it. I love body cams.
Right, and here's how I see the change in the 21st century. One of the tools that I'm trying to develop is a bio-optic sensor. So we know that when an officer's heart rate goes up to a human, doesn't have to be an officer, but a human heart rate goes up to 170 beats per minute or higher, they lose visual acuity and auditory acuity narrows. Mm-hmm. And this is a primal need. You know, one of the things I talk about is how we develop our survival instincts. It's not a chicken or egg. I believe in the use of the biopsychosocial model. But you are first and foremost a biological specimen. When you come out of your mother's womb, you're programmed for survival. It's the reason why you cry when the mm-hmm. umbilical cord is cut. You don't begin your socialization process till you start breastfeeding with your mother. And we know from fMRIs that oxytocin, which is the trust chemical, increases during that period. The trust bond begins. When you're separated from mom and you're put in the incubator in the little nursery area, some kids are naturally more agitated or easily more agitated. Some kids are more docile and quiet. And that's the emergence of personality. It happens fairly quick, but it's not a chicken or egg. Mm-hmm. It's biology first, sociology second, psychology third. So we know that then children are conditioned. And we know that some of us are better at interpreting social cues than others. A guy named Dale Goleman wrote a lot about emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. But when you're physically challenged or in a crisis, you lose all of your abilities. You become focused on your own survival. And I've seen this. I've been in firefights. And when that happens, my job is to save myself first. Mm-hmm. Right? So when that happens to a police officer, they can misinterpret some environments even before the firefight begins, and that's the hope. A bio-optic sensor is a tool that I believe eventually will be able to read the microfacial expressions of people that police officers are engaged in. And it's based on Paul Ekman's work. We all cross-culturally leak emotion through these microfacial expressions. They're very hard to pick up, particularly if you're engaged in an interview, you know, on the side of the road when you stopped a subject. Mm-hmm. So the goal is to have this tool that assists the police officer with understanding their situational environment and increasing their emotional intelligence so they have less chance of misreading or mm-hmm. misinterpreting the situational.
They can read the situation better, like you said.
Yeah, so that's one of the tools. But there's a ton of new tools that are coming out that will challenge police officers in terms of how they do their job and warfighters as well. Another major challenge is this degradation of respect that we're seeing among some members of the community. There's always been an element of our community that you know, thinks of police officers not as humans, mm-hmm. not as Officer Fitzgibbons, but as the popo, mm-hmm. the pig, right? I did a lot of research on radicalization. In fact, that was a lot of my time as a program manager of the Terrorism Research Analysis Program. What we know is that when you fall into the mindset of the box, we call it the box, academically or scientifically, they refer to it as cognitively closed, you become intolerant and unaccepting of others that oppose your viewpoint or worldview. And at this point in the box, you become extremist. You become radicalized or fanatic. And you can see the necessity to eliminate. And what we've defined is the difference between anger and hate. When you're angry at someone, you want them to hurt. When you hate them, you no longer want them to exist. Mm-hmm. So the true radical, the true extremist, the gangbanger on the street that hates the police and calls them the popo or the pig, can see the necessity for killing that officer because they're less than human in their eyes. And so when we have a world that avails itself to instruments of violence, and guns are readily available, then our officers will clearly remain a target for those who are in the box, who mm-hmm. are intolerant, unaccepting, and can see the necessity to kill the pig.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your opinion, Andrew, I mean, has it always been? I mean, I think it's gotten worse over time. You probably agree with that. I mean, do you think that the pendulum is going to switch to the other side? I mean, there's always going to be an element of people out there that don't like the cops. I know that. People know that. But do you think it'll swing the other way at some point?
I would like to think so. And I think, you know, let's go back to the models of relational policing. Mm-hmm. We know when you have a community where there's a high level of predictability behavior, you have in that community a high level of trust, public trust. So it's Boston strong, where there are those communities where there's a high level of predictability against a baseline of expected norms of behavior. You have less social controls that are required in order to maintain stability and balance, or what they refer to as social equilibrium. So the more we can establish stability in communities like in Chicago, where we have common values, mm-hmm. and again, this is, you know, a condition and a school issue, if nothing else, where that community sees and respects the law, then you have a higher level of predictability behavior against that common set of values. You have higher levels of public trust and require less social control in order to have stability and balance or social equilibrium. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to do that in places like Compton or Chicago? Absolutely. And I think as we advance scientifically in the approaches to policing, William Branton in New York City is a fine example, where community-oriented policing is more than a philosophy but is also a program that has measurables and metrics. Mm-hmm. And I think we can get to the point where we see ourselves less as law enforcement officers and just as much as peace officers mm-hmm. in those communities.
Now, I know you talk a lot about another topic I wanted to talk with you a little bit about. You talk about stress management, resiliency in law enforcement, emotional wellness is so important these days for officers, and it probably always has been, but I think it's on the forefront more today than it has been. Can you elaborate more on this, Andrew? I mean, I'm sure you were faced with so much stress in your career, and maybe you still are. What are some stress management tools for resiliency?
I tell you, there's a lot of good techniques to manage stress, and stress is not a bad thing as long as it's properly managed. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you look at the triad that I mentioned earlier, the biological, psychological, and sociological triad, those are the three balance points in our lives. And I always look at biology makes us human, right? Sociology teaches us how to behave in groups. So it teaches us how to behave in humanity or among other humans and understand humanity. Mm-hmm. And psychology, the schemas by which we see the world, teaches us how to be humane. And if we're balanced in those three things, and it's very difficult, Pat, you know, to be balanced consistently in those three areas. So when you're not feeling well, to have your wife or some support system there to help make you feel better does a lot to rebalance that triad. Mm-hmm. And so when we have, you know, people that are hurting in our communities, we need to pay attention. There's a number of people with mental illness that need our help. We can improve in developing tools to affect that triad, and that includes our police officers. So our police officers see stress from a lot of things, different areas, not just the work. A lot of friends of mine that are police officers get stress from home mm-hmm. and get stress from the department. And so there are some techniques. One is mindfulness training.
Oh, I love that. Love mindfulness.
Yeah, and you know what? It's something that's beneficial to people that outside of the police work.
Of course.
My kids, I have some adult kids and I have a very young child. And my kids, my adult children, when we have a dinner now, they will text the whole dinner.
No, Andrew.
Yeah, I said, put your phone down and stay in the present. Remain in the present. Connect with me. And we are multitasking at a rate we've never had in our history as humans. And that causes imbalance. So mindfulness training is one technique, and there's a lot of different techniques within mindfulness. Yeah. Practicing and increasing your emotional intelligence also builds resiliency. There are a number of different things. Some people exercise, to manage their stress. Some people will, paint. And I think the important thing, and by the way, one of the most popular classes that we taught at the Behavioral Science Unit at the National Academy was the stress management course. Because police officers, and, there's 350 that come to the National Academy that at any given quarter, police officers feel that stress no differently than, bus drivers or doctors or, mm-hmm. Anybody else. But when they got to the National Academy and they saw there was a stress management class that would help them build resiliency, they were happy to take it because they were practical exercises they could take home. Breathing is another one. Just mm-hmm. taking the time and deep breathing. It's not really transcendental meditation. It's just simple breathing, mm-hmm. Which we tend to forget. And I'm guilty of that. Sometimes I start, getting so wrapped up in my work that I forget that I'm supposed to breathe. And the shallow breaths that I take during the day add a compounded amount of stress at the end of the night. And I feel mm-hmm. tired. And I don't know why, because I didn't do anything except sit in front of the computer all day. Yeah.
I wish... And I know they teach us on the federal level, it sounds like in the NA that officers go to and probably the regular FBI academy. But I wish, Andrew, at least in Colorado where I'm at, I wish they would teach this more in the academies. And they don't. And I understand it's a packed curriculum. They got a lot to teach. But it is so important, stress management and resiliency. Everything you said is so important that we should be teaching our young officers. And we don't.
I couldn't agree more with you, and I think that if you did, you would, again, contribute to fewer altercations, because a lot of people who are on edge mm-hmm. See their lives more threatened than perhaps they really are in the context. Psychologists use the term context as defining time and space. And so when I'm stressed, I'm much more defensive. I'm much more keen on my own personal survival, and I'm probably going to misinterpret. And I'll tell you, anecdotally, there have been many cases where my wife has come home and I'm under stress from work or a project I'm working on, and she can sense that something's not right. And so, it absolutely is something that should be taught along with leadership. And some other soft skills should be taught to every recruit who comes through basic police academies. Mm-hmm.
Now, shifting gears again, I mean, what are some – FBI's, it seems like it's in the news, the Bureau's in the news a lot these days. What are some of the challenges for the FBI? Every organization has challenges, and maybe you can talk to it, maybe you can't.
Well, you're talking to a homer, so yeah. Let me preface that for your listeners, okay? So I was an FBI agent for 27 years. Yeah. I faded away last year at age 57. They take your gun and badge away because you're too fat and old. I was just telling people I was just hitting my stride after 27 years. But In any case, I tell people, I know the FBI history. I wasn't just an FBI agent.
I think they get a bum rap, though. I think the FBI is getting a bum rap. I mean, I don't know. I'm just an outsider looking in. But it just seems like they're getting raked over the coals every day.
Yeah, I'm not going to criticize the president.
Yeah, I know.
But I will say this, because I do respect the office of the presidency, mm-hmm. and I haven't always agreed with the holder of that office, but I do respect the office, and I wish he would as well. And what I mean by that is, if you have an independent investigation that is, they've stated again and again, this is not focused on the president. Mm-hmm. It may be focused on Russia's conspiracy. There's no such thing as collusion, but mm-hmm. the Russian potential conspiracy with members of the campaign, mm-hmm. but not specifically the president himself. But even if that were the case, it's an independent investigative body. Without the FBI as in its independence, you would have a federal agency that would be beholden and loyal to the president of the United States, no different than a despot in Russia. Mm-hmm. The thing that separates us from Russia, North Korea, Iran, the Philippines, is that we seek the truth. I was an FBI agent for 27 years, and believe me, we have good agents and bad agents, and I can list you some bad ones that were put in jail for the rest of their lives. We're not perfect. Back from 1957 to 1972, the FBI had a program called COINTELPRO. From 1946 to 1965, the various presidents of the United States, from FDR to Johnson, allowed the FBI unilateral authority to enter Americans' homes without a warrant if they suspected the American was conspiring to overthrow the U.S. government. This was before we even had a counterterrorism division. The FBI preceded OSI and CIA as America's first intelligence agency. From 1908 to 1934, FBI agents didn't have guns or arrest powers. FBI agents were analysts, right? And they collected data and analyzed it and turned it over to the Marshal Service or others to make arrests, and some were deputized at times. The point I'm making is the FBI's had a storied history, not always done the right thing the right way.
Well, it's any organization, Andrew. You know that.
That's exactly right. But I will tell you this. Everything I've seen, let's take I had a conversation earlier today in another show. We talked about the Hillary Clinton investigation. The question came up. The FBI conducted that investigation. It is complete. That investigation has a ribbon around it. So if the the administration thinks that Hillary is crooked, she's a crook, put her in jail. There is nothing, absolutely nothing stopping this administration and this Department of Justice from taking that investigation to a grand jury and seeking a true bill. Nothing. All right. So if they said that, wait a second, the FBI had evidence that Hillary Clinton violated the law, there's nothing stopping Jeff Sessions from pursuing that in terms of a criminal investigation, except one thing. Hillary Clinton represents a better return on investment being tried in the court of public opinion versus a criminal court. As you know, Pat, a criminal court requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt. In the court of public opinion, hearsay, lies, rumor, innuendo are all admissible.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's the issue. If the FBI implanted a informant in the election or the campaign to defeat Donald Trump, why did the director, Director Comey, come out 2 weeks before the election and say the FBI is continuing their investigation against Hillary Clinton, almost ensuring that she was going to lose the election?
Exactly. Exactly.
It's no sense. So all I ask your listeners and my other podcast I did today, the same request is, take what you read or see from the media with a grain of salt. Don't get in that box. Because when you're in that box, you're going to become intolerant and unaccepting of alternative truths. And when that happens, you lose your ability to critically think.
That's a good point, Andrew. Can you talk a little bit about your company and what else are you doing out there right now?
Yeah, so I'm involved in a number of different things. When I retired last year, the FBI did away with the Behavioral Science Unit. They now call it the Behavioral Analysis Unit 5. So I adopted the name, the Behavioral Science Unit, LLC. I provide consulting services. I provide three different types of products for security, usually security companies and individual clients. Everything from quote-unquote profiles, which I call behavioral assessment profiles, and then direct action plans to assist and due diligence investigations. And I also do domain threat assessments. So the company does those types of consulting. I also do research. I'm a researcher for RAND. But the bulk of my company is in training. I provide training that's listed on my website at www.behavioralscienceunit.com. You can go to the www.behavioralscienceunit.com, and I have a list of topics that I speak to. My training can be anything from 8 hours to 40 hours in topics like stress management and resiliency that we talked about earlier, in radicalization, in the psychology of terrorism, crisis management and crisis negotiations, and a number of others. Ethical leadership and relational policing. So yeah, if anybody in your audience is interested in that training, I can certainly provide that. I give a discount to police and to warfighters, but I also do a lot of private sector stuff. And I also do individual coaching to improve human cognition. So I have several clients that I speak to. I have a 10-week course that one is pretty interesting. It's called The Science of Happiness. And we talk about how humans make decisions and sometimes how we make poor ones. And I help people make better decisions in their life. Think before action.
Nice. Well, Andrew Brangle, sir, thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for your honorable service to this great country. It's because of heroes like you we have this great country, and I truly believe that people like you are what makes this country great. And I will have all your information, sir, on the show notes after. And we welcome you back anytime, Andrew. I could talk to you all day. I mean, you're amazing, man. You're so. we could talk for hours probably about different things.
We can get to my books, but I'm a peon.
Talk about your books for a couple minutes if you get a chance, if you want to.
Yeah, well, I've written and published in three books. The first one was a book of a collection of exploratory research topics called the Terrorism Research Analysis Project TRAP, which is available on Amazon. A collection of thoughts, ideas, and perspectives. I also wrote a chapter in a book called Blood Sacrifices, Violent Non-State Actors, Dark Magical Religious Activities. I wrote that a chapter a couple years ago. And then I wrote another book on combating global terrorism by a publisher called The Sitter. And I wrote a chapter on social equilibrium. And I'm currently writing a book on the psychology of terrorism for the layperson. Mm-hmm. I do that, and I do some podcasting work. But thank you very much for allowing me to do that. Let me just end by saying that I had a very enjoyable 27 years. My wife is an FBI agent still.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she chases pedophiles and human traffickers.
Well, good for her. Good for her. And unfortunately, there's a lot of them. You know that.
She's pretty busy. And then two of my three adult children aspire to be FBI agents. One is under a conditional job offer. She just graduated from Auburn University.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and in fact, one of my pet projects, and maybe this is probably a good time to end. We could talk about this later. I've been approached by a group of investors who are interested in developing the first United States Public Service Academy. So this school would be like the United States Military Academy, but would be for local, state, and federal civil servants, an all-hazards, whole-of-government approach to education of these future civil servant leaders. Mm-hmm. And then we're interested in developing an ROTC program where kids could go to school in other parts of the country called the Civil Service Training Corps. And you could go to school at any number of institutions that share the same core curriculum on ethical leadership and inclusion and diversity and governance. And then they would then spend summers in different workshops so that they learn the same basic standards for ethical leadership, servant mm-hmm. leadership, and those types of things. And then feed into local, state, and federal agencies with the skill sets necessary for the 21st century to make America great.
That's a great idea. Now, what is it, getting traction, Andrew, or what?
Yeah, well, here's the interesting thing, Pat. It was attempted back in 2006, mm-hmm. And a bill went before the Senate, and the Senate voted it down in 2006 and 2007, ostensibly because the argument was made that the government shouldn't run and it was going to be at DHS, and the government shouldn't run a school like this. Well, mm-hmm. these investors agree, and so it would be a school that would be run with the state, a land-grant institution. And, so we're looking at a couple of facilities, one in Virginia, one in New York, and one in Missouri. And it is starting to get traction. It's got a pretty impressive board of directors, former generals, some people from academia, a couple from the FBI, a guy from the Department of Homeland Security. And they asked me to see if I could help put this thing together. So I'm talking about it. We're developing some plans to how this school would actually work. If it does get traction and goes forward, I think it could be a game changer in terms of reestablishing that trust between the citizenry and the people that are in charge to work. I tell people, I'll leave you with this, actually. I work for the best bosses in the world, the mm-hmm. American people. And most FBI agents, they see themselves first as Americans before they see themselves as Republicans or Democrats or black, mm-hmm. white. We're a secular country built on based on laws. And when we lose sight of that integrity and virtue, doing the right thing the right way and maintaining law and order, then that's the beginning of our demise as a republic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good point, Andrew. And anything that we can do, the podcast can do to help with that project, please let me know. I would love to have you back on the show again to talk more about your expertise and some other topics that you talk about. So, my friend, thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it. Again, thank you for your honorable service to this great country for 27 years. Tell your wife to be safe. I'm sure she is. Thank you for what she does. As well as your kids. That'd be cool if they get on.
Yeah, it'd be great.
All right, buddy.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your service as well, Pat. Call me anytime.
All right, take care.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.